Professor Allen's Comics Reading Journal for the month of August, 2018. Welcome to episode 39 of this podcast series. The concept of the show is to just have a brief chat about what comics I've read since the last time we had one of these brief chats, which should make this sort of, pretty much, if you squint, the books I read during August. These books are listed weekly in blog posts at eyesandearsblog.blogspot.com, and I regularly repost them on my Facebook and Twitter, so you can find those. But those posts are not exactly spoilers for this podcast, since those are just lists. But here, we have a little more review, a little more critique, a little more discussion. But first, we have a little feedback. As I heard from Nathaniel Wayne of the very popular Council of Geeks YouTube channel about my shipping last episode of Doctor Doom and the gorgeous Wanda Scarlet Gorgeous Witch. Dear Professor, having listened to your latest comics reading journal, I found myself struck with your almost breathless tone when discussing romantic relationships featuring your beloved Dr. Doom. Of course, when speaking of Doom, you always have reverence in your voice, as well you should. But this, I felt, was a step beyond. You seemed almost envious of Wanda for having the opportunity to be the Bride of Doom, in addition to your frustration at her rejection of the same. Just between you and me, Professor, no one else is listening. Do you have a bit of a crush on everybody's favorite dictator? It's okay, you can tell me. I wouldn't report it to anyone else, not even the good doctor himself. And I am prepared to state with 86.9% certainty that I am not a Doombot. Geekily yours, Nathaniel Wayne. Well, let me just start with, not that there would be anything wrong with that, but no, my feelings for Doom are wholly wholesome and appropriate. If there is any envy coming across, it was for Doom himself, so close to living gorgeously ever after with the Gorgeous Witch. And on this thing about you not being a Doombot, Nathaniel, if that's who you really are, from what I understand, you have already produced more YouTube content so far this year than you did during the entirety of last year. Deny it if you wish, but there is evidence. I just have to say that that level of content creation, of productivity, it does speak to a somewhat robotic, some may say Doombotish, level of efficiency. Just saying. Retweets and likes and shares for that episode came from the following lovely people. Chris from Bat Books for Beginners, The Rad Adventures Network, The Mind of Scott X, Karen from Between the Pages, Weasel Skull and DJ Christados from The Long Box Crusade, Robert Ludwig, Sean from the Secret Wars and Beyond podcast, Old School Ross, Mike from the Kirby Cast, Gene from the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, Clinton from Coffee and Comics, and Laurel at Mountain Flower One. And on to the books that I read last month. And as I do on this show, I'm categorizing the books that I read. And first up are issues that I read specifically for podcast appearances. These are the homework books for an appearance on an unnamed secret podcast that probably won't appear for 3 or 4 months. I read the debut issue of one of my favorite of those indie characters from the mid-80s, Eternity Smith, #1. And that reread intrigued me enough to check out the rest of that version of the title, the version from Renegade Press, Eternity Smith, 2 through 5. It was fun revisiting the book, and I can see why I dug it back in the day. Did it hold up completely? Not entirely, no. But was it worth a revisit? And will I read the books from Hero Comics that continued the title sometime in the near future? Certainly, yes, I will. And for a super secret project that has ended up being unfortunately delayed, I read a bunch of books from one of my all-time favorite, extremely obscure characters, her entire publishing history, as a matter of fact, by reading Evangeline Special from Lodestone, which actually reprinted two earlier issues, and then from First Comics, Evangeline 1 through 12. These are books that combine some of my favorite concepts, futuristic religion and battle nuns. And comics I read for listening to podcasts: Adventures of Superman 527, Action Comics 713, Superman, Man of Steel 48, and Superman 104. These are among the quarter books that I purchased over time to follow along with Michael Bailey and Jeffrey on From Crisis to Crisis. Now, these weren't necessarily the greatest examples of books of Steel from this era, but the Man of Steel issue that had Aquaman as a guest star, that was a good read. Probably my favorite was the Adventures issue featuring the return of the Alpha Centurion. That one had good action, but the fact that the Centurion has a crush on Lois made for a nice, fun subplot. Those specific issues were covered, by the way, on From Crisis to Crisis, episodes 221 and 222. And another podcast adjacent book, last month, I read the independent version of Captain Marvel from 1966 for an appearance on Back to the Bins. I remembered that in my stack I had a related book and I found it. This was given to me by the great Kansan Gregor Rujo, Captain Marvel, presents the Terrible Five. This was an interesting book, actually, the way it was laid out, where the stories of the five bad guys were all related, leading one into the other. And, of course, the fact that the cover not only mentions Captain Marvel, but not that Captain Marvel, but it also has the words Dr. Fate and Dr. Doom on the cover. And this convinces me that the company had a business plan that involved being sued for copyright infringement and getting paid a nice fee to walk away. Did I mention that the cover also has a blue-clad stretching character? Because, yeah, it does. And on to new comics that we read right off the shelves. And these are all from the DC Universe line of books. Adventures of the Super Sons, number one. For the purposes of continuity, they point out that this 12-issue maxi-series takes place before the Bendis stories that are going on now in the Superbooks, because in those, John's status has changed. That sort of thing doesn't matter to me. I like these characters, I like their interactions, and I enjoyed this first issue. I assume this is the setup for the whole thing, or at least the first chunk of it, with the Sons taking on a team of aliens who are basically cosplaying their favorite villains. So we have Kid Deadshot, Joker Jr., Brainiac 6, Ice Princess, Shaggy Boy, and the leader of the gang, which is actually what they're called, the gang, Rex Luthor. Green Lanterns 51 and 52, Dan Jurgens, is writing this final storyline for the title, another one that I'll be sad to see go. It has a bunch of lanterns in it, all doing vaguely lanternish things, although there is a mystery to solve. Who has the power to attack Mogo, and then seriously injure another lantern, and then, ready for this, kill an actual guardian of the universe? And whoever it was, could they have done it without some inside help? From inside the GL Corps? So it lays out a pretty good mystery. The Hellblazer, 24. This is the end of this volume of Hellblazer although I wonder with him being a recurring character on the upcoming season of Legends of Tomorrow, if he'll get another book or maybe appear as a recurring guest in something other than the upcoming Batman the Damned. I don't think that one's in continuity, so maybe the new Justice League Dark will be his eventual home. Not totally sure, but in terms of this final issue, I enjoy the way this all ended, and I liked the combination of Hellblazer and the Huntress. They shouldn't get along together, and they didn't get along. But it nonetheless, they made for an effective team, actually, and certainly an entertaining read for a couple of issues. And as we just mentioned, Justice League Dark, number one. Shout out to my LCS, World's Greatest Comics, and Jeff, the owner. Because I didn't hear about this title until after the first issue was out and the store had sold out of it. But he was able to special order a copy and got it to me just a few weeks later. I appreciate that. In terms of the issue itself, this either ties into or maybe spins out of Justice League, No Justice. We have Wonder Woman leading a team that includes Zatanna, Swamp Thing, Man-Bat, and Detective Chimp against enemies too fantastic for the regular Justice League. I love the concept of this type of team, and as we talked about on the latest Short Box Showcase and about 45 seconds ago, if Zatanna is on the team, John Constantine can't be that far behind, and he did show up for a page or two. Wonder Woman 51 and 52, after the big events of the Dark Gods storyline, Steve Orlando begins his time on the title with an intriguing first issue that takes place from the current day into a number of years into the future. The action of the issue is just Wonder Woman regularly visiting Mayfly, aka Moon Robinson, in prison. Their conversations are revelatory, giving some interesting insights into her character. And then we start the first storyline, which plot-wise I was a bit confused by, but it is just a first issue. I did want to mention, however, that this version of Diana artistically, how Eiko and David Lorenzo drew her, especially in issue 52, and then I assume going forward, especially in the face, it is very reminiscent of David Ace Gutierrez's future ex-wife, Gal Gadot. And on to the general comic reading that I did, direct from the quarter bins at World's Greatest Comics. Spider-Man Unlimited number 1. This is the 2004 series, which was a bi-monthly anthology featuring two stories per issue, usually by writers without a significant body of previously published comics work. In this one of these stories was really good, with Spidey giving joy to a chronically ill child, and then Spider-Man faces off against an old villain, Slide, who's gotten himself a ridiculous villain makeover. Should have been funnier than it was, but it was decent enough. I also read The Outsiders, number 24 from 1987. This was one that caught my eye. The cover did, and that rarely happens. Generally, covers don't make all that much of a difference to me, except if Dr. Doom is on the cover, of course. Now, The Outsiders are not necessarily my favorite team, but like I said, the cover image caught my eye. It's a fight between Geo-Force and the Russian bad guy Fusion outside of Air Force One with President Reagan looking on. I picked it up out of the cheap box, immediately flipped to the last page. This is a pro tip. And I was glad to see those important two words, the and end. And the story was pretty much that story from the cover, and it was almost as good as that cover had promised. Now, from the dollar bins at Journey Into Comics, I read Agent Carter number 1 from 2015, part of the 50 Years of S.H.I.E.L.D. special event. It's a fun story set in 1966, where Dum-Dum tasks Peggy to test a new recruit to S.H.I.E.L.D., the Lady Sif. Of course, things go crazy right away, and it turns out that Peggy's assignment isn't exactly as it was presented to her. Now, I'm not sure where I got this next one from, probably Paul Hicks or Rob Lance, as it was sort of Free Comic Book Day related, and that was DC Nation number 0, 3 all-new stories for only 25 cents, which sounds like a great deal, unless you think about it as 25 cents for a book full of house ads and previews, because that's pretty much what these stories ended up being. Previews for the summer storylines of Batman, Supes, and the Justice League. And they were all pretty decent prologues for those events. I liked the Batman one the most, and although the Bendis intro to Superman was interesting, and the Justice League one, it was just kind of confusing. But I'm not reading the Justice League, so that probably makes me easily confusable in relation to that title. From the $3 for $1 sale at Comics Town, I picked up Wanted, the World's Most Dangerous Villains, number 1, which was a reprint title that put out 9 issues in 1972 and 73. They reprinted first appearances of villains, in this case from the 1957 to 1960 era. And the characters in this issue, the World's Most Dangerous Villains, were Clock King, Puppet Master, and Signal Man? Look, I like this concept. DC has a deep bench of terrific villains, but none of these three, let me repeat, Signal Man, Clock King, and Puppet Master would crack the top 100 of DC's greatest or most dangerous villains. Me and Em and Mrs. Quarterbin attended Heroes Con in Charlotte, North Carolina, in the middle of June, over Father's Day weekend, and from the wonderful $5 for $1 boxes, thank you, Luke Giaconetti, I picked up a book from Dark Horse, based on a Sci-Fi Channel reality show from a little while back, which the entire Professor Quarterbin Middleton family watched. Who Wants to Be a Superhero? Feedback, featuring the winner of Season 1. Stan Lee is credited as the writer for this, and he did have some role in the show, so I suppose that's possible, although I suspect a ghostwriter, not that there's anything wrong with that. The book is described as Computer Whiz Matthew Atherton is tricked by Ironside, the world's deadliest terrorist, into helping him perfect an unstoppable robot vehicle, little knowing that Ironside intends to use the vehicle to destroy Matthew's hometown. Left for dead by the terrorists, an unexpected event turns Matthew into feedback, giving him one chance to redeem himself and save the city. It's not a terrible little story, actually. And the book itself includes mock-up covers for all of the participants in that season of the show. And that was fun. It really brought back memories of the contestants in that show. So it was a surprisingly entertaining read. And from a recent care package sent in by Sir Iowa's Joe, I read Marvel Now, Point 1. This was a book from 2012, which had a S.H.I.E.L.D.-based frame story, but mostly that was an excuse to present previews of a range of Marvel Now books, Nova, FF, Secret Avengers, The Guardians, and others. Again, I'm not sure what I think about books like this, which are essentially long-form house ads, but to give the DC Nation book credit, it was 25 cents. This one was $5.99. Mark Sweeney from the ITG blog and podcast sent stuff in a little while back, including House of Mystery, number 1, a Vertigo book from 2008. It had a lot of the talent from Fables involved, Matthew Sturgis, Willingham, Todd Klein's letters, Lee Lockridge on colors, and it was appropriately Vertigo-y creepy. I don't know how much of an ongoing story the title eventually has, but you can see the groundwork being laid for one here, although you have stories that could work as a series of weird standalones as well. So an interesting book. The Great Kanzan Gregorujo of the Secret Wars and Beyond podcast sent in Hectoplasm de Mortuis, a horror anthology featuring a bunch of stories about ghost hunter Hectoplasm. I didn't get the joke of the name until I said the name out loud, kind of quickly. Hectoplasm. Good variety of short stories, a pretty long issue, and not a bad read overall. I wish, like that House of Mystery book I mentioned just 25 seconds ago, I wish I'd thought to save these until October. Some of the kids' books that I read, some from the generous Canadian Rob Lance, some from the cheap bins at World's Greatest Comics, included Richie Rich and Jackie Jokers, 20, Cave Kids, 11, Snagglepuss 3, Top Dog, number 1, and The Phantom Blot, number 7. The Phantom Blot one was actually pretty good. It was a full 32-page Disney story, meaning it had a beginning, a middle, an end, and a conclusion that actually made sense, and had some drama and humor along the way. Cave Kids, on the other hand, was a pretty ineffective take on the Flintstones. Top Dog was interesting because it was a Marvel book from 1985, and it didn't take place officially in the Marvel U, but the lead boy character, Joey Jordan, was wearing a Spidey t-shirt. Thank you, Rob and others. Great variety, great choices, great reads. Well, that means it is time to take a break here, and when we come back after a promo, it's time for another installment of our Doomtastic new feature.
Hi, I'm Tom Morris Jr. You might know me from my two decades with America's Most Wanted, or currently as the crime analyst on the A&E Network TV police documentary show Live PD. Now, I'll be hosting PD Stories, a new podcast from A&E Networks and Audio Boom.
Whatever goes down, you're the first officer on the scene of a murder, even though. You'll get there before the homicide guys get there.
On Live PD, you get to see police officers doing their jobs in various jurisdictions across the country. PD Stories is a forum where law enforcement professionals tell you firsthand about their careers and what you can learn from their personal experiences.
And so for me to be a new officer in the gang unit, to see something that violent happen to, you know, kids coming home from church, mm-hmm. and to make the apprehension of those guys and get convictions, you know, for these guys, that was honestly the proudest moment in my career.
On this podcast, you'll get in-depth stories told in their own words by police across the spectrum.
Well, as a profiler, I want to go to the scene and see where everything happened. I want to know where the offender could have hidden. I want to know why the body was placed in a certain location. Was it intended for the victim to be found or not found?
And within that canine unit, they'll have bomb dogs, narcotics dogs, cadaver dogs, accelerant dogs. They even have now a dog that's trained on computer components.
From patrol, narcotics, homicide investigators, state troopers, and other agencies.
When you enter a hostage situation, it's like going into the middle of a movie. You don't know the beginning, you don't know the end. The first 10 to 30 minutes of any hostage incident is called panic reaction.
I mean, I remember literally the first night I was a rookie officer on my own, out of field training, maybe 25 minutes before my shift got over, I got in a fight with a guy over crack cocaine.
Make sure to sign up and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode.
And now we have the latest installment of our latest segment for the show, inspired by a comment by DragonCon's Michael Bailey. So like we did last episode, we'll be analyzing a piece of comic narrative featuring Dr. Doom. From, of course, Dr. Doom's perspective, or as we call it around here, the truth, without what Big Comic would have you believe with their hashtag fake continuity. So, let me welcome you back to Dr. Doom's Fireside Chat. But it is with a heavy heart that I present to you this particular segment this month. because something has changed since we began this segment. Back when Dragon Con's Michael Bailey was merely podcasting's Michael Bailey and suggested that we do this. For when that recommendation was made and this segment was initiated, that was the golden age. A golden age which has sadly come to an end. Because starting in the early 1960s and running for more than half a century, we were in a modern dark age. Yes, it began in the comic book world, but you can't tell me that it didn't affect the rest of pop culture, to say nothing of the rest of the world. I refer, of course, to the foisting upon the world, an unsuspected and unprepared world, that thing called Fantastic Four. Yes, that comic title introduced the good Dr. Doom to the welcoming world. And certainly, Fantastic Four Annual 2, The Origin of Dr. Doom, is a crowning literary achievement. But when you're talking about 50 years of comics, over 600 issues, of course there are a few highlights. All you need for highlights is stories of Dr. Doom. But think about the untold damage that the Fantastic Four did to the world during that time. Not just to the world of feature film, but obviously, that's where a lot of their damage was done. But even with the dozen or so, maybe a score, of epic moments featuring Dr. Doom, were those moments worth the other 600-plus issues of non-Doom content that title produced? I think not, and many thought not, and eventually Marvel Comics thought not. For then, at the end of April 2015, lo, our long national nightmare had come to an end, with issue 645, and of course that total includes some very, let's say, intriguing numerical manipulation, but after, quote-unquote, issue 645, the Fantastic Four title would no longer be produced, and the people rejoiced! And Latveria rejoiced, and Doom was pleased. And all was well with the world we entered what Latveria's greatest historians have come to call the modern golden age. Just think about it. The progress in society. Peace breaking out across the globe. Unemployment plunging. Global stock markets rising. No complaints or protests following any elections anywhere. Social media, trolling, and hatred. That had come to an end. Just think about how great those years were. For 170 consecutive Wednesdays, consecutive new comic book days without a Fantastic Four title. Those were the days, the glory days, days of rejoicing and celebration. But all good things must end. In our glorious era of having no Fantastic Four comic title in production, sadly, that came to an end on August 8th, 2018, a day that will live in infamy, a day when a new Fantastic Four title debuted. And yes, Dr. Doom is in the book. He's a major character, of course. And that's a key thing to remember here. The Fantastic Four title recognizes the simple fact that it needs Dr. Doom in it as a major character to be successful. But Dr. Doom does not need the Fantastic Four. That's the key. Solo miniseries, Doom 2099, Secret Wars. These are all places where Doom has thrived with no, or in a few cases, very minor contributions from Reed and his family of failures. Doom has worked with all of Marvel's biggest names. Iron Man, Spider-Man, Dazzler, Hulk. He just doesn't need those jokers in blue to make him viable. But you know what? They need him. Now, obviously, this has been a tense month for all good Latverians and the worldwide membership of Pod, the Pod people, Pals of Doom. It's been a time of sadness, yea, grieving, perhaps. And out of respect for the feelings of Latverians and Pod people worldwide, in this time of cataclysm and catastrophe, so many people who are just so confused when they entered a comic store recently and saw that book for sale with those characters. It was reasonable for everyone to assume that they were gone forever. In comic books, dead means dead. Once you're gone, you don't come back. So this return is an offense not just to us Pod people, but to all good comic book fans around the globe. We must all rally together against this new title. And in that spirit of shared action and activism, I've been asked by the Latverian consulate here in Central Ohio to forego the reviewing of any Doom-related comics for this segment, just, we assume, just for this month. This topsy-turvy, mixed-up world in which we find ourselves living now, it just wouldn't be prudent to do that at this juncture. I do wish all my listeners peace and comfort in these difficult times, but knowing that Doom will not rest until that title is again where it belongs, on the cancellation list, and that team resigned to the dustbin of history. Except for Miss Susan Storm, Doom's statement was quite clear regarding this aspect of the matter. She has his number. Give him a call. All right, we do, sadly, have other non-Doom-related comics to talk about, because I do read other books sometimes. So let's take a break, play another podcast promo, and we'll come back to talk about graphic novels, miniseries, and long runs that I read during August.
Adam Curry, John C. Dvorak.
Time again for the team unofficially known as the G2, fighting disinformation and lunacy all across Gitmo Nation.
This is No Agenda.
From the Crackpot Command Center, burrowed in the southwest quadrant of Gitmo Nation East, I'm Adam Curry.
And from the Silicon Valley North, and why am I shouting, I'm asking the other guy, I'm John C. Dvorak.
It's Crackpot and Buzzkill in the morning.
No Agenda, the best podcast in the universe. Unhinged analysis.
We can't use unhinged anymore. It strikes me. I see it. Whoa.
Unglued analysis.
Unhinged, updated to unglued.
Whose story is going to be better?
And unglued is better.
If you wake up with the blues, trying to fill your day with news, there's one thing you must remember, No Agenda in the morning.
For a healthy, balanced news diet, try noagendashow.com.
Joe Biden, and thank you for taking the time to listen.
The best podcast in the universe.
And we're back. Again. To talk about the graphic novels, trade paperbacks, collections, miniseries, and runs that I read in August. In this segment of last month's episode, I talked about the Free Comic Book Day books that Paul Hicks and Sir Rob Lance set in, and I mentioned that one of my favorites was Street Angel's Dog by Brian Marika and Jim Rugg, and that I was planning to read the previous books from that character. So I read The Street Angel After School Kung Fu Special, The Street Angel After School Kung Fu Special, The Street Angel Gang, Street Angel Hero for a Day, and Street Angel Goes to Juvie. These are all 30-page, pretty much disconnected, one-off stories. And what I love about them so far is that there is no attempt to explain or give an origin. We are told that Jesse Sanchez is the most dangerous ninja in the world, and that's that. She is. So why explain it? But she's also a schoolgirl. There are some funny schoolgirl moments, including an awkward school dance. But then again, weren't they all awkward? I liked all of these, with my favorite probably being the Street Angel Gang. And this one, Jesse joins a gang because their tryout flyer promised food. And she ate all of it. This earns her the name Trash Can. And after thinking she has passed the initiation, there is one more secret final step where the whole gang fights her for 2 minutes, and if she survives, she's in. But not only does she survive, she actually destroys the entire gang, leaving herself the only member, but she does get to eat all their food. The trip to juvenile detention, that issue was a weird combination of sad and joyous. Very well done, and overall the series is a little bit deeper than you'd think. In the parcel, sent recently by the generous Canadian Rob Lance, he sent some books featuring an interesting Marvel character that I thought I had some more of in the stack. Those had been sent in by Sir Iowa's Joe, so I had a little mini marathon of reading about this character. And that was Hercules, Prince of Power, from 1982, 1 through 4, Hercules and the Heart of Chaos, 1 and 2, from 1997, and Hercules, Twilight of a God, 2 through 4, from 2010. These were all interesting in their own way, although the one in the middle was a bit weaker. For one thing, it was 1997, and there's some 1990s-ish touches in the stories. And also, as good as DeFalco and friends are as a creative team, they ain't Bob Layton. And when it comes to Hercules, it's hard to beat Bob Layton. More than a quarter century separate the first miniseries from Twilight of a God, but they really seemed of a piece, bringing back the recorder as well as Hercules in a lot of ways and trying to tie things all together. It's really interesting, and I think this is like an underrated or maybe overshadowed part of Marvel Cosmic. Jim Starlin, and rightly so, gets a lot of the credit for developing that side of the Marvel U, but Bob Layton and Hercules deserve a bit of credit as well for contributing to Marvel Cosmic. Sir Iowa's Joe sent a bunch of comics in recently, including 4 issues of a controversial character from various controversial titles. These were Miracle Man 3 and 4, and Miracle Man by Gaiman and Buckingham 1 and 3, all from the 2014 Marvel reprints. I have mixed feelings about Alan Moore, the individual. Actually, my feelings aren't all that mixed. I really don't like him all that much. But Alan Moore, the comic book writer, there are very few who have done it better for an extended period of time. Forget that his feelings about Marvel led them to refer to him in these issues as, quote, the original writer, unquote, because he didn't want his name associated with the books. How silly that sounds, how wacky that makes him sound. But they are still really, really good, and if anyone is going to pick up on that and write future stories, it's hard to think of someone better than Neil Gaiman. And Mark Buckingham's art, I'll take that anytime. So these were really good, and even with high expectations, they were really good. I can't remember who the originator of the story I'm about to tell is, but I heard it on the film criticism podcast, Battleship Pretension. And that is that if one particular year, the top 10 highest grossing box office films happened to feature male leads in red shirts, the only lesson that movie executives would take from this would be, we got to make more movies with guys in red shirts. Now, I say that because I think for the last 10 or 15 years, maybe, entertainment companies of all sorts have been looking for dark stories. And they get this, at least in the comic book world, from looking at Watchmen, Daredevil Born Again, The Dark Knight, Identity Crisis, Miracle Man, etc. But I think, like the red shirts, they took the wrong lesson. Yes, those stories are dark, but they aren't just dark. They also have substance. And I think that's more often than not what readers really want. But comic book CCOs and executive editors decide that dark, grimdark, was all that we wanted. But that's just male leads in red shirts. Sometimes men in red shirts are also into really good movies. That happens sometimes. But the key was not the male leads in their clothing choices. Or with comics, it wasn't the grimdark, the dark for dark's sake. In both cases, the key is content, which comes from quality writing. Miracle Man is dark, yes, it's a deconstruction that is absolutely merciless. But it works not just because it's a dark deconstruction. It works because it's really well done. It's a deconstruction that operates at a very high level. We want quality, we want content. Sir Iowa's Joe also sent in Invincible Iron Man 2 and 6 from last year from the Riri Williams version of the character. I haven't read much about Ironheart, but I like the little bit that I've read of her. And this is good. The discussions between Riri and her AI based on Tony Stark, that's pretty good. And there's also a subplot about the current state of Latveria, and that is always worth paying attention to. I decided to put to the test last month my purchasing philosophy of the most pages for the lowest price. So I grabbed from the quarter bins at World's Greatest Comics two books from the legendary Marvel event, The Evolutionary War, The Spectacular Spider-Man Annual 8, and Silver Surfer Annual 1. Both of these, of course, are giant size, 64-page annuals. So the question is, can I find some quality pages among that huge quantity of pages? And the broad answer, taking both books and their 128 pages of totality, is not a whole lot. The Silver Surfer story was interesting, with the Eternals and the Surfer and the Super Skrull. That was the regular size story, but the backups were a couple of 4-page previews leading into other books, and about a dozen art pinups. And I know that comics are a visual medium, but for me, I need art to be in service to a story. So those 12 or 14 pages of pinup art were largely unimportant, pretty much wasted pages for me. But then we have the Spider-Man one, which is the return, quote-unquote, of Gwen Stacy. Not a bad idea, I guess, and the emotional aspects of the story for Pete and MJ, that sort of works. But the plot itself was somewhere between bad and really bad. And the backups in this one were the Young Gods, a group I have no interest in, and I don't think were all that good anyway. So lots of quantity in these books, and almost enough quality to justify the bright, shiny quarter that each one cost me. But I don't know that I'm going to jump for joy when I see any more Evolutionary War crossovers in the quarter bins. They are not automatic pickups. And I discovered in my comic stacks that I had two consecutive issues of a classic Bronze Age title, one that I picked up from Journey into Comics and one from the quarter bins at World's Greatest Comics. These are The Brave and the Bold, 187 and 188, with Batman teaming up respectively with The Metal Men, and that's always good, and Rose and Thorn. Like I say, I've always loved The Metal Men, and this was an interesting story with some pathos to it, surprisingly enough, about the missing metal woman who Tin had fallen in love with. It also put Doc Magnus firmly in the camp of Mad Scientist. There was also a backup feature in both of these telling parts 2 and 3 of a story featuring Nemesis. It wasn't bad, But in both cases, the lead story was way better. Back at Heroes Con, the kind and lovely Luke Giaconetti gave me some books, including Weird Worlds 1 through 6. This was the anthology series that continued into the New 52 era as my greatest adventure. So this series, Weird Worlds, featured ongoing stories from the characters Lobo, Garbage Man, and Tanga. And I know what you're thinking. Garbage Man and Tanga, those are household names. But that other guy? Lobo? Okay, no, that's not what you're thinking. But I do have to give this title credit for avoiding the problem with anthology books of having as many stories that you don't like as the ones that you do. Because I actually liked all three of these. Garbage Man was a standard muck monster character, but the story was pretty good. And Tanga, I'm not sure if the irredeemable Shag has ever read this, but...
What? She is hot.
Yes, that is true. She is. And I'm not really a fan of Lobo, but that wasn't a bad story either. The Lobo story did totally wrap up after the sixth issue, while the other two wrapped up their sections, while also leading into the new storylines in the rebranded My Greatest Adventure title. So overall, this was a kind of surprisingly strong anthology book. And I read a trade sent in by the generous Canadian Sir Rob Lance, collecting the entirety of the IDW series from 2010, Yours Truly, Jack the Ripper, 1 through 3, based on a 1940s short story from the great writer Robert Bloch. This story proposes a supernatural in explanation for the ongoing presence of the Ripper over the decades. It's an interesting story adapted by Joe and John Lansdale, with creepy atmospheric art by Kevin Colden. Between prose and comics and TV shows, I've read, I don't know, dozens of versions of this basic story of Jack the Ripper continuing to exist and expand his reign of terror into the modern age and beyond. But this was one of the earlier of those, I suppose, being more than 75 years old, the original story, of course. And among those, this was pretty good. And from the Bat family, from a few years ago, I read Gotham City Sirens 1 through 13. This is the adventures of Catwoman, Harley Quinn, and Poison Ivy as roommates, teammates, and, depending how you define the term, friends? Maybe? A nice balance between individual stories and longer arcs for the lead characters. Each of the Sirens get their focus issues, but they also had good group team-building moments as well. There was an arc that featured the Riddler, which wasn't that bad, and then Poison Ivy gets a real job at a biotech research facility, which makes sense for her and her interests, but not so much for her personality and management approach. But she did get some of those management ideas from Lex Luthor, so that explains a little bit. She actually does quote Luthor a few times. And those decisions do come back to haunt her in the form of a disgruntled worker. Those stories were written by Paul Dini, and they did have a similar feel to the animated series, especially Harley, of course. Interesting idea for a series, interesting stories, and I imagine I'll read the other 13 issues sometime soon. And a similar book, taking a well-known female characters and doing a different spin on them, I read Betty and Veronica, Vixens, 1 through 5. The pitch of this one is simple. What if Betty and Veronica started an all-girl motorcycle gang? It's jarring, it's odd, it's hard to believe, but the core of the girls' personalities stay true. And that's really what matters. Okay, the notion of Cheryl Blossom moonlighting as a roller derby girl, that part doesn't quite ring true. But ringing true is not really what this book is about. It's about girl power, and that's what it does, and it does it pretty well. It's a strange book, but I don't think I disliked it. How's that for an endorsement? Also on the Hoopla app, I read Scooby-Doo Team-Up 19 through 24. This continues to be a fun read, and in this one, Quick Draw McGraw, Harley Quinn, Martian Manhunter, and Zatanna are among the many guest stars that appear. My favorite overall issue is probably Quick Draw, because he also appeared as El Kabong, which did not trick a single member of the Scooby Gang. But it did certainly give him a great opportunity to do some kabonging, and that's always good. But my favorite individual moment is from the Zatanna story. When the team talks to every other magic character in the DCU, we see many of these on panel, but not all. And there's a reference to an unshown meeting with Constantine, or, quote, that English guy with the rumpled coat, unquote. Zatanna just crosses her arms and says, I don't want to talk about him. I sent that page to M, and they said they love the fact that Constantine has officially become Zatanna's embarrassing ex-boyfriend. Now, I've only read one issue of Frankenstein Jr., never seen any episodes, so that issue of Scooby Team Up was a bit too obscure even for me. The last one was a bit heavy-handed, an anti-alien story, but it had a twist that set it apart. So overall, this was a solid trade, another solid trade, a great mix of exploring all areas of the DC, and in this case, Warner Brothers, back catalog, and telling legitimately funny comic book stories. And another of my Hoopla Archie finds was one that I mentioned last month, the Archie 1,000-page Festival. I picked this up because we did a lot of traveling a lot in late June and early July, and I figured having a single nice long digital book that would be, you know, a good one to borrow. But, and this is a good thing. Problem is, I stayed busy enough at those events, as the Audio Feed Music Festival and before that Heroes Con, that I really didn't have much time to read this. So it took a little longer than I expected. And the main thing I have to say is, 1,000 pages is really long for a comic book, even an Archie book, which can be a pretty quick read. Now, a book this size, no surprise, had a couple of stories that I'd read recently before in other collections that I recognized, including the not very good Panda Stealing Mystery. But again, overall, a fun read, and there are enough beach stories to make Archie fun summer reading. And I think that's everything. In terms of my favorite reads of the month, Scooby-Doo Team-Up is always high on the list. Super Sons and Justice League Dark both got off to good starts, and the Agent Carter special was really good. Street Angel stayed really good. But I'm going with Miracle Man by Gaiman and Buckingham number 1, which is a reprint of Miracle Man 17 from 1990. In this one, people are making difficult physical pilgrimages to meet Miracle Man for the purpose of praying to him, of petitioning him, for various things. And it's kind of intense. And it's Neil Gaiman, so it's very well written. Next month, I've got some Conan on the reading pile and got some Convergence miniseries that I skipped over when they were new, when they were full price. Other than that, I'm not sure what all I'm going to read next month. But rest assured, whatever I do end up reading during September, I'll talk about here. And that episode ought to be out sometime in early October. Feel free to let me know what you think of this episode, what you think of any of these books that I mentioned, especially if you've read any of them. You can send that feedback via email, relativelygeeky@gmail.com, or as a comment on the Facebook and blog post for this episode. The blog is at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com. You can follow the network on Twitter at relatively_geek. And of course, the network has its own page on Facebook as well. Come join us. All are welcome. Thanks for listening. Keep the pages turning.